last week until you said that.
Really? Morning.
Good morning.
How are y'all doing? Do I have enough lights on? Volume set okay? Don's not here. You guys aren't that good anymore? Don's not here. I'm hoping I got the appropriate number of lights on. So, do we need more? Oh, we need side lights, right? Does that help? I doubt it. Let me try it. See what I can do. I'm like you. Is that enough light? Do you want the lights on in the front? No, it won't help any. Yeah, I think the lights in here are a little warmer than cooler. They're a little yellower and at least we're not monks having to read by candlelight and stuff like that. So, okay. We're going to start a new quarter today in our year-long study of God's plan for us. This quarter is called "Thing This We Do." So we think we studied. Last quarter was "This We Teach." Was that what it was? And this one's "This We Do." Anyways. So we'll start out with worship today. We're going to do worship next week. Some of it will break down into what we do during worship, I think. I think we get into the looking at the Lord's Supper, looking at singing. The instrumental music question is week 11 or 12. Offering. Some of the things we do during worship, we're going to look at each of those parts. So as we go through this quarter. So anyways, I'll kick it off today. If you are looking for an awe-inspiring lesson that'll change your week, you're probably in the wrong spot. Mike O'Neill's teaching in the back room. I've looked at his lesson 3 times and kind of did something that overlaid what I already had, and I don't know how this is going to come out. I think it's one of those lessons that I can tell you everything in it in 10 minutes, or I can take 3 hours to do it appropriately, and somewhere in the middle, it probably doesn't come out nearly as well. So anyways, we'll see where it goes from there. So it's worship, part one. A picture today is a kiteboarder that I caught at sunset a couple weeks ago. And it looked a lot better in person than it does up there. But anyways, that's kind of the stuff that we saw. So today we're going to look at worship. 3 parts we're going to look at. We're going to look at Old Testament worship. We're going to look at synagogue worship and heavenly worship. Okay? By looking at these 3 kinds of worship, what are we leaving out? Or are we leaving anything out? New Testament worship, yeah. I think Weldon's going to cover that next week, or Chuck, or whoever's got it. Chuck's got it. I don't know why I get confused right now of who's next. So Chuck, I think, is covering that next week. So, yeah, we're going to try to look at those 3 different things. Like I said, some of that could take 5 times longer than you think it should. What does the term worship mean to you? Praising God. I should have brought my chocolate, shouldn't I? But does chocolate work in the morning? Throw out cereal or something? I don't know. So what else? Praising God?
Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Yeah, Thanksgiving, because everything he provides for us, which is not just our physical needs, but he provides. Lloyd is probably in tune with that very much so, more so today than even in the past, huh? I bet so. I'm willing to say that. Clayton?
To me, I accept the fact that he is who he is and that I bow down.
Yeah, that's part of it too. He is who he is. He's God. And we bow down to that. And you're right. That's a big part of worship too.
Well, worship to me is reserved for only one person.
It is. And I think that's really the whole. That's the whole point of today's lesson, I think, that really sets up that our worship is for God because he's God, and it's not for us. Linda? Yeah, we reaffirm that he's our God. That's his place. We tell we establish our place in that relationship too. It's a lot, well, it's different than any other relationship we have. Yeah, he's a lot bigger than we are. Yeah, he's a lot bigger than us. He's perfect. We humble ourselves to that. Yeah, that's what worship is. Anything else? Honoring God. That's part of it. Anybody got a pet that absolutely adores them, absolutely worships them? We don't. We have a Cocker Spaniel who's known to be just mean. But some animals, some people have pets. They follow them everywhere, and they sit in their lap, and they absolutely worship and adore them. And you, do you really? You're lucky. It's not a Cocker Spaniel, I'll guarantee you that. Yeah? A really smart poodle, huh? She'd do anything for you, wouldn't she? Yep. And it, you're just done if anything happens to her. That's a good relationship right there. That's how it ought to be. So, like that, you can kind of understand that worship relationship with that. As is most commonly used in the Bible, it refers to an act of paying homage, saying reverence to God. You know, I looked that word up to see how to pronounce that. Because I've heard it said homage, and I've heard homage and homage. Anyways, homage is what Americans are supposedly supposed to say, according to Cambridge. But anyways. So as it's most commonly used in the Bible, it refers to the act of paying homage, showing reverence to God. Words translated as worship or worshipped appear in our common English Bibles close to 200 times. I use the New King James, and worshiping is like 197 times in the English Standard. New King James was like 190 times. So this word's a very common thing throughout the Bible. But that's by and large what it's used to mean. The Hebrew word for worship conveys the idea of one bowing before another. And Clayton pointed that out earlier. That's exactly what that word means in Hebrew, which would be the Old Testament. In the New Testament, the word most frequently translated as worship is derived from a term often used to describe how ancients would bow down before those in authority and kiss the feet or the hem of the garment. Again, same kind of idea. So yeah, that's what worship means. So as we take that idea of worship and we carry it into why we worship and what we do with worship, we have to understand what the word really means. Does it really carry that same connotation in 2015 as it did in Hebrew and Greek? Now compared to then. More than now. Yeah. The whole culture was built around that. I'll give you that. Definitely in the Old Testament. Yeah, we definitely see that today. The New Testament, same way, I guess, really with the synagogues. When you see what the Pharisees and the scribes wanted to do to Jesus because they're afraid of losing their position, losing their power. So yeah, even their economic system was built around that. I think though standardly, maybe we don't see worship as exactly the same way as bowing down. Okay, take it a step farther. Yeah, the world bows down to its own creation. We bow down to a God that we can't see, a God that we can't feel, a God that we know is there. And really that bow down part, if you look at Matthew 15, verses 8 and 9, Jesus says, "Hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy about you, saying, 'These people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, and in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.'" So does biblical worship require more than just outward actions? And how do we properly worship God? So along the same thoughts of what Clayton was saying, taking it the next step farther, does it take more than just a physical bow down to God? Yes. What's it take? We bow with our hearts. Bow with our hearts, exactly. Okay.
So I can bow down to him and lie, and I know he knows it.
Yeah.
Even though I do it sometimes.
So, yeah, it does make sense. You're right.
But I accept the fact that he's all-knowing.
Yeah, we're not perfect. God is all-knowing. He knows our motives. He knows what's going on. Like you say, sometimes we fake it. Fake it till you make it. You might come in here.
We might do it for wrong reasons.
We might come in here for wrong reasons. We might come in here to check the box. Came to church, check. Wife's happy, check. Got people to go to lunch with, check. You know, yeah, we can do it because of that. It can be a country club rather than us honoring God. And that's, like you said, maybe that sets up for a point where you can. It's not something you can just turn on and off, turn on if you've had a life of not paying respect to God. So maybe it takes a little while to build. Weldon, do you have something? Yep, it's not the day we have to go to church, it's the day we get to go to church. It's the day we get to go to worship. Yeah.
It's like a desire. You know, I desire God to be who he is no matter what I do. Because when I do it, I
do. Yeah. Linda? Yeah. Yeah, see, yeah, the Caesars, for instance, not only were they a king, but they were a god. You definitely see that through like Daniel and stuff. Nebuchadnezzar is a god as well as a king. Yeah, and they demanded that worship. The price was your life. And the difference is, right, we willingly bow down. We willingly bow down our life, our heart to God. So, yeah, there's a big difference in that. And building that heart to want to do it rather than feel that we have to do it. It goes along with Weldon's thing. Not because we have to be here on Sunday morning, because we want to be here on Sunday morning. That's, yeah. This morning, as part of worship, the elders have challenged me, I will use the word challenge, to get the young men to lead part of the worship service this morning. And part of that is trying to build that heart in them to want to do that, you know, as it grows over the years, as we all age, forget to get them to develop that heart that they want to. So I don't think I twisted too many arms this morning. I hope. We'll see. But anyways, that's part of that, is trying to develop that heart, and I'm hoping that heart's developing in some of these guys, especially when I consider one of them is my son. John 4:24, God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. So how do we worship God? In spirit and truth. Huh. From the heart. Will our heart lie to us? Sometimes. The heart's been known to lie to us. Yeah, without God's Spirit, you're right. Our heart will lie to us all the time. It's got to be trained. Mary said that. It's got to be trained to do it right, to find that truth, to seek the truth. What's that? Yeah, you can believe a lie. The world's a lie. That's part of becoming a Christian. I've lived a lie. Now, Jesus is the Son of God. He can run my life because I do a terrible job at it. So, yeah. So, right there is your whole instructions on how to worship God. Finding out how to do it, there's little details here and there, but I mean, really it boils down to this. So, that's where we will go later. Starting out, I guess, really with Leviticus 18:24-25. Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things, for by all these nations I am driving out before you have become unclean. And the land became unclean, so that I punished its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. Left to its own desires, our heart will lie to us. Left to its own desires, people will engage in religious rites that range from ridiculous to grotesque. This is a description of Canaan. This is a description given to Moses that says, when you move in there, these people are basically going to get out of the way. The land is vomiting them out for their practices. The Canaanites were the, at the time, the greatest idol worshipers around. I say at the time because I think the Israelites probably got to be even better than they were when they moved in. Baal was a, they kind of mixed their worship practices. They wove them into nature. Baal was the god of the sky, brought thunderstorms and rain. Asherah was the earth goddess who gave fertility and crops. Worship involved sacred prostitutes at shrines. Okay, we don't probably need to go any farther than that. That doesn't probably sound like something God would want, does it? So anyways, that's people's heart on how to worship their gods, which they saw in nature. That's where it led them. Backing up a couple verses in Leviticus 18:21, you shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech, and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. Canaanites believed in their gods were powerful enough to demand what was the most precious to them. And yeah, that's a child sacrifice. Is that amazing? It's time for you all to do this. And that's what they would believe that their gods would do. So left to their own desires, people will do bizarre stuff. If you want to look at some worship, I recommend the Psalms. David has an amazing heart. He's flawed like us. He has a heart that pursues God. He sees God in a lot of things. You can almost follow his emotions. He's at a high, goes low and back up, or he's low and goes up and back down. You can follow his emotions through most of the Psalms, especially if you know a little background on his life. But a lot of it is, you'll see where he might be running scared or suffering the agony of sin, but he always gives glory to God. And you can see that worship in just about any of the Psalms that you ever pick up. Psalm 100 kind of gives you an overview of what our focus on worship should be. Make a joyful shout to the Lord, all you lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before his presence with singing. Know that the Lord, he is God. It is he who has made us, not we ourselves. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Enter into his gates with thanksgiving and into his courts with praise. Be thankful to him and bless his name, for the Lord is God. His mercy is everlasting. His truth endures to all generations. So, what's our focus for worship? It's on God. How come? Because he's God, right? You can almost just say, because he is. And it's just, you know, it might sound like an answer that I'd get back in one of the classes with the kids, but you're going to be hard-pressed to give a better answer than, because he is. That's just kind of how it goes. So do we sing a song that kind of matches these words? We do, don't we? I don't know if we're going to sing that song today or not. There's a good chance of it, especially with some of the, with the young guys leading worship. So we might. I don't really know. Anyways. That's our focus. We worship God because he's God. Old Testament worship. And this is kind of where the two sets of notes that we use, they both come from the Gospel Advocate, but one's like a book for the whole year and one's a quarterly thing. I think it's really a student book, and the two sometimes go hand in hand and sometimes they go this direction. And today's one of those days when they went this direction. So anyways, you get my version of what that means. So Old Testament worship, although Cain and Abel paid homage to God with their offerings in Genesis 4, the earliest use of the word that's translated worship comes in Genesis 22. Genesis 22:5 says, then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. And if you follow it up with verses 6 and 7, you know where we're at in the story. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac his son, and he took it in his hand and fire and a knife. They went up, both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, my father? And he said, here I am, my son. He said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for a burnt offering? So you know where we're at, right? Where are we at? What's happening in this worship? He's going to offer. Abraham's going to offer his son. There's no quotes around offering. There's no quotes around worship. This is it. The first time we see the word worship is what we understand with worship in the New Testament. God gave his only son for us. This is Isaac giving his only son. That's the worship. That's how serious it is. So, anyways, the focus is all on God. Moving on to verse 13, Genesis 22. Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took his ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So after God kept Abraham from sacrificing his son Isaac, why do you think Abraham offered the ram as a burnt offering? And in verse 14, it says, so Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide, as it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. So why do you think, go ahead, Linda. No, you're right, it wasn't his only son. It was the son of promise. You're right, it was not, because Ishmael would have been the first son. But this is the son of promise. You were absolutely right. I should not overlook that. Actually, I corrected Camille's board in her class when she had, I put Ishmael and put another line out to hers.
Why did Abraham offer a ram instead?
Yeah. No, and what?
He asked for a way out.
Like, yeah, he did it because he asked for a way out, but God provides. So he offered his worship because God provides. God provided him a son. Right, and that's actually, I think it's verse 8, 22:8. I should have put that up there. Like I said, I could have gone forever. Is it 22:8 when he says, God will provide? Because Isaac says, where's the lamb for the burnt offering? He says, God will provide. Linda? Yes. He knew God had something worked out. A God that promised him a son and gave him a promise of a land inheritance, a whole seed promise. A son at 100 years old. You know, I mean, I'm almost 50. I don't expect any more kids, let alone 50 years from now, right? Probably. Never can tell, but probably. But he gave it to him. He got the son of promise. Sarah and him both laughed at that. God provided a son. If God demands his son, and he's already made me another promise, he keeps his promises. I'll do what he asked. On top of a mountain. God provides. And that's really what it says in verse 14. He names it because the Lord has provided. And that's why he worships. The Lord's provided. He provided me a son, so I worship him. He's provided this ram. I worship him. Yeah, he probably carried his son on the way back down. Yeah, I'm sure he was more than thankful. You're right. That's like, is that verse 9? 8 and 9? Maybe not. And that might be in Hebrews. Yeah, he solely has to rely on God because you're right. Although God knows he can raise people from the dead. Yeah, Abraham has not seen that at this point. In his journey, he lost his father halfway through the journey to get to this point. So yeah, you're right. He knows how death is. Did you find it, Weldon? I'm with you. It's in there. It might not be in the Genesis account, but it might be in the, is it Hebrews? I don't know. Yeah, he fully knew that God would, if he had to sacrifice his son, God would provide a way to bring him back to life. So.
Yeah, but God already knew he was going to have to send his son to save him.
Yep, God knew from the beginning. Yeah, God knew he would have to send his son. His son would have to die. But he didn't let Abraham go through that pain that he would have to go through. That's a good point. Isaac had to live. To carry out that promise God made to him, Isaac had to survive. Whether he wasn't sacrificed or he was resurrected, he had to. And that's a faith that's astounding. Yeah. The knowing that promise is so secure that it's going to have to work out.
Even the Christians that follow God, if a Christian knows that he's going to die, but Jesus promised resurrection.
Yeah. Having that hope that God, knowing that God's going to keep his promise, he's going to resurrect us. Our lives are limited. And as we get closer, like you say, having that faith that he's going to keep that promise.
Well, that's that part of worship. Once again, since you said that, you had said, God gave himself for me, what do I not give?
Yeah. If God gave himself for me, what do I not give? That's the heart. That's the heart. Hebrews 11:19. Okay. That's it. Abraham's faith was such that he knew that God would, even if he had to give his son, he would bring him back from the dead. Come. Okay. Good. Thank you. Chuck?
It's kind of interesting because nobody's been brought back from the dead. Why would he believe that?
Yeah, nobody's been brought back from the dead. Why would he believe that? He didn't see any other way for the promise to work. And he's just that, yeah.
But he'd already seen a miracle with his wife and his baby.
Yeah, he's seen God's power.
And didn't she get her mouth shut up too for a long time?
That was somebody else, wasn't it? John the Baptist's dad. Zechariah, is that his name? Yeah. Yep. Same kind of situation, though. We ain't going to have no kid. Yeah. But I think she still laughed, though. But she probably laughed harder when she found out. Or Abraham laughed at her, one or the other. So, anyways. All right. So, worship by the patriarchs and the people of Israel under the law appealed to the senses in a way that New Testament worship did not. I like that word. And, it really did. In the wilderness, God instructed Moses concerning the dimensions and adornments of the tabernacle. Exodus 26 tells how to build a tabernacle. If you ever want to build one in the backyard, knock yourself out. You can probably do a pretty good job at building one, okay? It starts out with, moreover, Exodus 26 verses 1 through 3, moreover, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twined linen and blue and purple and scarlet yarns. You shall make them with cherubim skillfully worked into them. The length of each curtain shall be 28 cubits, and the breadth of each curtain 4 cubits. All the curtains shall be the same size. 5 curtains shall be coupled to one another, and the other 5 curtains shall be coupled to one another. And it goes on and on. The tabernacle was a portable worship place. You could snap it apart. People carried things. They could snap it back together as they wandered the wilderness. And there you go. Linda? Yeah, and they had to know what cherubim looked like to weave them in there. You're right. And they're on top of the ark, the same way, the outstretched wings. We did a VBS on the tabernacle, I don't know, 5 years ago. And we built one in the back room. I think we figured about 2/3 scale. It's VBS. You know, help's cheap. The instructions are great. We're used to working with a little bit more precision than what God put down in one chapter. But we could come pretty close. We could add some kind of a guess of what it looked like. And he's very detailed in there. Like I say, you can't build an airplane from it, but you can build one.
You look at this passage and talk about the completeness of the instruction of God's plan. Go back to Noah, the instruction he gave Noah and building the ark, the completeness of those
plans. Yeah, it's just as complete. You're right. The completeness of the plan of Noah on how to build an ark, how long, which kind of wood, what kind of pitch to use, what to put inside the ark, how to build a tabernacle. These plans are very detailed, very precision, very complete. Our plan today, exactly the same way. We might not see that it's letter by letter by letter, but it is absolutely just as complete. It's not nothing left out. You're right. It's absolutely just as complete. The skills it took to build a tabernacle, there's silver, there's wood, there's tapestry, there's leather works, there's gold working, silver working, there's all kinds of stuff. It takes a lot of different skills, a lot like a church today. It takes a lot of different skills. We've got speakers, we've got song leaders, we've got people who show mercy, we've got people who love kids, we've got people who hate kids. But we've got a little bit of everything here. That was just a joke. But we got a little bit of everything to make it work. And that's what it took to build tabernacles, what it took to build the temple, the same way. God called a royal priesthood and instructed them about the way they were to make sacrifices. Again, Exodus 28, you can see this is about our uniforms. Then bring near to you Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the people of Israel to serve me as priests, Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. You shall make them holy garments for Aaron, your brother, for glory and for beauty. Yeah, it goes around on how to consecrate these holy garments, what colors, what pieces, very detailed instructions on how to be a priest and what your clothes would look like. Very detailed instructions in Exodus 29, verse 10 through 14, and more on sacrifices. Then you shall bring the bull before the tent of meeting. Aaron and his sons shall lay their hands on the head of the bull, and shall kill the bull before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. You shall take part of the blood of the bull and put it on the horns of the altar with your finger, and the rest of the blood you shall pour out on the base of the altar. You shall take all the fat that covers the entrails, and the long lobe of the liver, and the two kidneys with the fat that's on them, and burn them on the altar. But the flesh of the bull and its skin and its dung you shall burn with the fire outside the camp. It is a sin offering. Again, very detailed instructions on what you're supposed to do. And these are... The worship involved a lot of senses. You can see colors. You can see there's obviously smells involved. How to get that blood off you, I don't know. I'm sure the tabernacle itself stunk blood. And we just always would. But a lot of senses. It's very, very detailed instructions on how Old Testament worked. Rituals were elaborate. The rules were meticulously prescribed. Amidst the ceremonial instructions, the law emphasized that God wanted the heart of his people. And underlying the sacrifice is the love of God. And that's, although we had these meticulous instructions, we can't miss the fact that, like Deuteronomy 6:5, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your might. And if you know, you should know, we carry this all over into the New Testament, same thing. This is how we're supposed to worship God, with all our heart, mind, soul, and might. Heart, mind, soul, yeah. That's right. Because William and I wear some of the wildest ties known to mankind, right? So we don't wear the official robe of the priest. You're right. Chuck, too. I will give Chuck credit for that. He looks like, what? Yeah, but you're right. But it's our hearts. It was always on the heart, but the heart has to drive a lot of that. It's got to be trained. It's got to be, the heart has to see how to do it right.
One way I look at it, I know it's
Yep, the Old Testament you had to, the New Testament you want to. We don't have this strict set of rules like that. There's still...
So it shows us going toward a relationship.
It's a relationship. Right. Right. And I've talked about it before, is that relationship, if you invite me over for hamburgers or something, if you really want to please me, you'll make hamburgers the way I like hamburgers. You know, if you want to just, hey, come on over hamburgers, it'll just be hamburgers. Yeah. Yeah, if you really want to make it my way, you know, if you really, really want to get on my great side, you'll make them, you bring out the stuff that I like on them. You get to know me a little bit, you know. And that's the same kind of thing. And that's, I say that because sometimes I'm not the easiest to please. I mean, I got, if you have toppings and hamburgers, what would you put on them, right? What would you bring out? What would you lay out? If you were having a cookout for hamburgers, what would you put out? Onions? Mustard,
lettuce, tomato,
bacon, cheese and bacon, Chuck says. See? But I can't eat bacon, so I have trouble with bacon, so that one doesn't work for me. Which is fine. There's nothing wrong with bacon, and bacon pleases a lot of people. But if you wanted to please me, you wouldn't have bacon on my hamburger. And you put, like I said, you'd put what I like. I like onions. I like grilled and raw. I like Heinz 57 and A1. Okay? A58, as it might be called. It's my particular way. Everybody's got their own particular way. And if you want to please you, you'd learn to get close enough. You know, if Camille called me from Five Guys and said, I'm going to order your hamburger, I wouldn't even have to tell her how to order it. Right? She already has that figured out of how to please me. Unless she's mad at me, in which case it'd be bacon, lettuce, mayonnaise. Yeah. Or the Burger King way, they will give me a negative burger sometimes. Me and Grant both. Grant likes Burger King, and we'll go there, and he wants mustard only. And they will do, like, everything but mustard. I've never figured out the negative Whopper, but... Well, anyways, that's it. And I think that's the same kind of relationship with God. The more we want to worship him, the more we want to love him, the more we'll seek out what is it that he likes. What is it that he likes to have? Psalm 27:1, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? David worshiped God for providing. The Lord is my light. Oh, sorry, I just read that. When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. Though an enemy encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war arise against me, yet I will be confident. In verse 6, it finishes up, and now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me, and I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody in my heart. Melody to the Lord, excuse me. David praises God for his protection. He says he's going to worship in him in his tent. New King James, it says worship him in his tabernacle. If you back up, verses 4 and 5, he really talks about that. This is where David himself desires to be. One thing I've desired of the Lord that I will seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord, to inquire of his temple. Anyways, because God provides, because God takes care of David, this is where he'd like to be. That's where he feels most at home. Psalm 148, you can see the ultimate praise and worship. Praise the Lord from the heavens, praise him in the heights, praise him all his angels, praise all his hosts, sun and moon, all you shining stars, you highest heavens, you waters above the heavens. Good luck on coming up with more praise than that. I promise synagogue, or at least get into it, synagogues have no place in the worship of Israel in the law. They don't exist in the Old Testament. They exist in the Old Testament, they don't exist in the law. As Israel breaks into Judah and Israel, as Israel disappears into Assyrian captivity, as Judah disappears into Babylonian captivity, they basically find a way to worship. The community worship for the Jews at the time of the law is three feasts. There's the Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. That's when they came together to worship. They did not come together to worship on the Sabbath. The Sabbath was a day of rest. It was not a day of worship. But as they get into captivity, as the temple goes away, as the priests go away, as all the sacrifices and stuff go away, when they're in captivity, they find a way, they turn back to the law of Moses, and they want to know more. So they find a way to get back together. So they come together in what they call synagogues. And this is something that becomes a tradition, and that tradition goes on until Jesus' time. You'll see it. Jesus talks in the temple. In the synagogue. But this is when they came together on the Sabbath day. So that's where synagogue comes about. Synagogue worship had a regular pattern. They had prayers and hymns to open and close services. They read from the Torah, which is the Pentateuch, the first five books, however you want to look at it, prophets and psalms. They read from the Targum, which is a commentary, an explanation, and a homily, which is a sermon, were read by one of the synagogue's elders. Sounds a lot like our worship here, right? That's what our worship's modeled after, is the synagogue worship. It's not modeled after the temple worship. Because I don't think Chuck slaughtered a bull at the door this morning, did you?
No, okay.
Chuck did not slaughter a bull at the door today. And like I said, the temple worship was very, very different, the Old Testament worship. The synagogue is more along what we've done. We followed more of their model. As we look at what God wants, he likes prayers, he likes songs, he likes us to study his word. The Lord's Supper is established by Jesus himself. Offering is something else they did. Our model follows that. We'll get in more into that, and I'm going to give it up from there. Reading from Isaiah, huh? To be in a real synagogue in Israel, in Jerusalem, where, like you say, some place like Jesus would have stood up and read.
Is there a synagogue in Titusville?
I know there's one in Vieira.
Okay.
I don't know if there's a synagogue in Titusville. Okay. There's a mosque in Titusville, but I don't know if there's a synagogue.
Mosque, that's Islam.
Yeah, I know there's a mosque, and I know that's very different, but I do know there's one of those. Is there a synagogue? No synagogue in Titusville. There's a mosque, yeah, but there's no synagogue. I don't think there's one. But I think there's one in Vieira. There's one in Vieira. All right, I was going to talk about heavenly worship, but heavenly worship is in heaven. And Chuck will take care of it next week with worship part two. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. You're good.